Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm having to start today because Susie's got a banana in her mouth. And apparently bananas, did you know this, are not good for speaking.
Broadcasting.
Apparently not. Why is that?
There must be a word for this. Well, apparently I need to drink a bit of tea. Excuse me a second.
You're drinking tea?
Mm-hmm.
What's the origin of the word banana?
Banana, banana, banana. I just remember a Terry Pratchett quote, which is, Nanny Ogg knew how to spell banana. She just didn't know when to stop. Because it's banana, 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 isn't it? When you're a child and... talking about bananas. Anyway, the origin is, I suppose, originally it came to us via French, then Portuguese, then Spanish, all sorts of languages. This is a good example, actually, of the many, many journeys that each particular word has meant. But it goes back to, ultimately, the name used in Guinea, Congo.
So this is one of the many words that have come to us from around the world to the English language. Welcome to Something Rhymes with Purple, our English language podcast. My name is Giles Brandreth, and I'm with my friend Susie Dent. Since we were last with you, we've been bang-a-bonking, because that was the wonderful word you introduced us to last time, which means, again, bang-a-bonk?
To sit lazily on a riverbank.
Lovely.
I can still hear the banana, can you?
I can still hear the banana. We probably will for the whole podcast. Do you know, there's something so irritating, can I tell you this, when
yes.
People phone up and give you a call, and I say phone up as if people are using landlines. Nobody uses a landline anymore unless when they're at home, we've still got a landline. Don't ask me why. We've got a landline. Whenever it rings, I know it'll be somebody over 80.
That's absolutely right. I no longer have one.
And when it rings, my wife says it's going to either be Barry Cryer or Nicholas Parsons. And it genuinely is. They're the only two people, now that June Whitfield has died, They're the only people I know who still use the landline. But even on a mobile, this works. People phone up, and as they saying hello, they bite into a sandwich or a wrap or indeed a banana. It is so annoying listening to somebody munching and mulching at the other end of the phone. I really find it irritating.
Yeah, I promise you I will not do that. The banana has been put away and I've had my tea. I would just say, you know, you mentioned there phoning up. And that's not something we do. It's funny how they're called linguistic skeuomorphs, which is a really odd term.
Linguistic skeuomorph.
Skeuomorph. And they're essentially words that are fossils, really, because they no longer apply to the technology that we use. So we talk about dialing a number. When did we last have dials? We talk about hanging up.
There may be older listeners to the podcast who will be delighted to remember the time when in London... Because this is coming from London, England. I know people are listening all over the world, including London, Ontario, and indeed London, Ohio. But in London, England, we used to have telephones that you put your finger in and you dialed because it was in a round. And in London, there were names. Flaxman was one. Trebovia was another. Piccadilly. Mm. And the first three letters were letters that you... So New Scotland Yard was Whitehall, 1234. So WHI, 1234. And that's how you did it. So we talk about dialing a number. We haven't had a dial for, 50 years. We talk about phoning people. We haven't had telephones for a generation. When I'm calling somebody... Oh, that's what I'm doing. I'm calling somebody on my mobile, am I?
You're calling someone on your mobile, yes, but you're not hanging up on them. Are you anymore? And what's the other one that we use? We're talking about filming things, because nobody really uses real film. Well, I suppose some people do, but it's all digital now. So there's quite a lot of these linguistic skeuomorphs. Anyway, I digress.
You do digress.
Yes.
But that is allowed. This is our podcast where we celebrate the English language and we talk about words. Susie is a word genius. She knows more about words than probably anybody on the planet Earth. She used to work for the Oxford English Dictionary. She is the toast of Countdown on Channel 4 in the afternoons. The best thing about 8 out of 10 cats do Countdown on Channel 4 late at night. And she is just a word guru. Do you have a favourite word?
My favourite word changes all the time. One of my abiding favourite words, I suppose, is halcyon, because I love the sound of halcyon.
And halcyon days.
Halcyon days, the cool, calm, tranquil days.
Interestingly, does the word halcyon ever occur without the word days following it? Do you talk about...
Very rarely. I do, but I don't think anyone else does.
Halcyon's an adjective.
Halcyon is an adjective.
And capital H, small h?
Small h, and it was another word for the sort of bird that was associated with a kingfisher, really. And it goes back to a legend, to a myth, that the kingfisher would lay its eggs, the female kingfisher would lay its eggs on the surface of the water, and the god of the wind would calm the water so that the eggs could hatch in complete tranquility. And so halcyon days, the days of the kingfisher, and I love kingfishers, very important to me.
But actually, that's what we want when we go bang-o-bonking.
you can't get away from that, can you?
we want a halcyon day, but it's totally calm, so we can be on the riverbank.
And we can gongoozle our lives away.
What?
Gongoozle.
What's gongoozle?
It's to stare for a long time at water and just drift away in your head. Gongoozle.
Gongoozle.
Mm.
Oh, how lovely.
You can look at boats as well. Quite often people will call boat watchers gongoozlers.
You are basically English, aren't you?
Yes.
I am partly English, but I'm a large part American.
Are you?
My great-great-great-grandfather left the United Kingdom in 1833 and went to the United States of America. He left from Liverpool and he went out called Ben Holmes. Mm-hmm. That was his name when he got onto the boat. He got off the boat calling himself Dr. Benjamin Brandreth.
Wow. What happened?
He wasn't a doctor, and Brandreth was his maternal name.
Uh-huh.
His grandfather had been someone who was a pioneer medicine man and had invented a pill, which he then called Dr. Brandreth's pill, which was a kind of homeopathic remedy. For everything.
Okay. Only as part, because you mentioned in the previous podcast that a Brandreth was a...
substructure of piles.
Of piles. There you go.
But actually, Brandreth pills cured everything. That was his claim. And he took these little vegetable pills to America in 1833. Mr. Holmes changed his name to Dr. Brandreth. He thought it sounded stronger, more scholarly. He gave himself this degree. He was never a doctor, no more of a doctor than I am. Anyway, called himself Dr. Brandreth. He arrived with these little vegetable pills, and he made a major fortune. When I say major, he was one of the richest men in America.
Wow.
A multi-millionaire. And became a New York State senator, great friend of P.T. Barnum, the circus man.
Yes.
Anyway, he was...
amazing.
He was amazing.
Amazing also to just, in the course of a voyage, entirely reinvent yourself. I'd love to do that.
And he turned out, well, so the point is, he had lots of children. But the reason that we don't have any money is that he had 16 children with two wives, and they all had lots of children. So by the time the Second World War came around, the money had all disappeared. I am descended from his son, who was sent back to England to run the British end of the Brandreth pill business. And 100 years ago, Brandreth's pills were famous. 130 years ago, they were hugely famous. Mentioned, for example, in Moby Dick. Captain Ahab is constantly taking Brandreth's pills.
Seriously?
To keep himself well. Yeah. But what I'm trying to get to is that I'm American in part.
Okay. Were they tabloid pills, by the way? Because that was the first meaning of tabloid, was really compact tablets.
Oh.
Oh no.
They were round. I have got a little bottle of them. They were round pills. Mm. But that's the origin of the word tabloid.
Tabloid, yes.
So it's not keeping...
tabloid medicines, little tablets.
And the tabloid newspaper?
Tabloid newspaper was a compact newspaper, compact in size.
And it means taking it like, making it like a tablet.
Exactly.
Making it smaller.
Yes.
Dr. Brandreth was American. My forebears are American. What I want to talk about, please, today, is American English.
Mm-hmm.
Who invented it? Why is it different from ours? In America, until the people went over on the Mayflower, what language did they speak? What did those who are now called Native Americans, the actual original inhabitants of America, what did they speak and how did they learn English?
Oh, gosh, what a story. Well, they spoke not one, but many, many different indigenous languages. So depending where you were in the States, in fact, even in one place, you would find several languages, which greatly influenced English. So we have to say that from the start. So you might find, if you look in the OED, you might find the language of Narragansett, so near Massachusetts, Narragansett, it's called. You might find Arawak. You will find, so many different languages. I couldn't even begin to list them all. And I'm jumping ahead here, but when those Pilgrim Fathers went over on the Mayflower, there was obviously a huge language divide. And the story goes that it actually was a native called Squanto who actually rescued them, because they were actually in dire straits in terms of communicating with the outside world and therefore sort of, you know, making any kind of living, because there's only a certain amount of self-sufficiency that you can have. And he was their sort of translator and interpreter. And it was he who really encouraged them to kind of pick up quite a lot of those native words.
So what is this guy called again?
He was called Squanto.
Squanto, yes. And he is a Native American.
He was a Native American. Cool. You'll find pictures of him if you look online, meeting a group of fairly bedraggled, fairly miserable Pilgrim Fathers who were really struggling. And they then took on words like possum or moccasin, raccoon. A lot of those words come from those indigenous, Native American languages. And of course, we've changed them because we couldn't get our tongues around, or they couldn't get their tongues around, those sort of very foreign sounding words, which is what we do all the time. We absorbed lots and lots of words from those encounters into English. And yeah, I mean, honestly, where to start? Because American English is one of the most vibrant, wonderful Englishes, and I use English in the plural because there are many Englishes across the world that you could possibly ask for. I am a staunch defender of US English. When in Britain, American English gets an extraordinarily bad rap, and very unfairly so, I think.
Well, today, I've just looked this up, according to the US Census Bureau, around 2.9 million US citizens identify themselves as American Indian or Alaskan Native.
Amazing.
And while more than 70% of those say they only speak English at home, a native North American language is spoken in the homes of nearly 15% of them. Uh-huh. Goodness. Navajo is the most commonly spoken native language in the US, with nearly 170,000 speakers, 10 times the number of that speak the next two most popular native languages, which are Yupik and Sioux, as in S-I-O-U-X. So, those are the original languages.
Mm-hmm.
Then, basically, it's the people who invaded those are the other languages that are spoken. So it'll be Spanish and French and English.
And English. So many Spanish words, yes.
But English has stayed as the dominant language.
Yes, it has. And it's a very particular type of English, but actually it is in many ways not too far away from our own. I know we think that there's a sort of massive divide and gulf between the two languages, but actually they have so much in common. And so many of the things, Giles, that we complain about in Britain these days, the American spelling, for example, you know, they spell aluminum, or I'm doing an American accent, which should be a
positive. You're stereotyping, stereotyping.
I know, like the best of them. That we complain about honour without the U, about colour without the U, etc. And what people don't realise is that actually Shakespeare, if you look at Shakespeare's first folio, he used those spellings far more than he used the apparently British version. And they're actually closer to the Latin, which is something that most British speakers, you know, quite like a bit of.
My line on spelling is this: if you are writing as well as Shakespeare, you can spell any way you want. If you're not, you might as well learn the traditional spelling in whatever country you are in, because it will help you make progress. Because people may be superficial, but they can't see the wood for the trees, and if you spell badly, they may think that your thinking is sloppy. The point is, in Shakespeare's day, there was no settled spelling.
There was no settled spelling, and you will find, I can't remember how many different spellings of Shakespeare, but there were many, many of them. He even spelled his name twice differently on the same document, which was his will. The spelling of his own name that he never used was the one that we use today. I mean, it was in chaos. It was in splendid, unstandardised, isolated chaos.
Because this is probably a time when very few people read or wrote.
Yes, and we're talking about, you know, before the sort of heady days of printing, which did standardise spelling very much. But the key thing is that Shakespeare used a lot of what we now consider to be American spellings. He also used the I-Z-E ending for verbs like realise. Now, I use that all the time, and whenever I use it,
I don't like it
on social media, there you go,
yeah.
I get the, what, you're using the American spelling? No, it's the Oxford way, because it's closer to the Greek original. So etymologically speaking, the Americans even know a thing or two. And who cares? I mean, I-Z-E to me looks right, but why do people care so much that it's not I-S-E?
Because we want to get it right.
But okay, You are getting it right both ways, I have to say. The dictionary will give you both.
Oh, break time.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
Hello, it's me, Jamie Lang, and I've got a new podcast, and this time there are no gimmicks. It's just great company. Because the thing is, I realize the reason I love podcasts so much is because they're a great way to connect with people.
Hello, I'm Youngblood.
Joe Brand.
I'm Paloma Faith.
Jay Blades.
Elizabeth Day.
Zara Larson. Casper
Lee. And I'm Great Company.
Great Company.
Great Company.
Great Company.
Apparently.
It's Great Company with me, Jamie Lang. Coming Wednesday, the 27th of March.
Now, let's hone in on American English. Am I right in saying that basically spelling becomes standardized through the evolution of printing, mm-hmm. and then particularly when dictionaries come along, the most famous British dictionary being the one created by Dr. Johnson in the 1750s?
Yes, although there were many dictionaries before then, has to be
yes.
said.
Yeah. But that's when it began to become standardized because you needed the same sort of spelling in a dictionary.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Yes, yes.
More or less?
Yes, more or less.
In America...
Yes.
Noah Webster is yes. the equivalent of Dr. Johnson.
Yes.
He creates the first big American dictionary.
Yes.
And he is logical.
Yes.
And basically, what he says is, let's make these words spell like they sound.
Yes. And who can blame him? And, you know, that sort of push for spelling reform has been with us for a very long time. There is still the Simplified Spelling Society who would ask for exactly that today. It's worth saying that English, as I say, English spelling is very, very difficult. And we know that our kids struggle with it, and they struggle with it for good reason. But for me, once you learn the stories behind the spellings, you actually unpack the reasons for them. And that's part of the excitement. That's part of the adventure of English. But the reason, one of the reasons why our spelling is so difficult is that pronunciation and spelling divorced really centuries ago, and we still live with the consequences. So unfortunately for us, just when those printing days were coming along and William Caxton was setting up his printing press, we had a bit of a phonetic trauma, if you like, and we began to change the sounds of words but left the spellings as they were. There was something called the Great Vowel Shift, which sounds incredibly boring, but basically we think it was because Londoners started to talk in a sort of cool, slangy way that other people wanted to emulate. It was fashionable, and their cool way was changing the sort of sound of things. And so gradually the sound moved away from the spelling. So that is kind of where the British were, but it was seen as British and therefore correct and the standard. What Noah Webster wanted to do, as you say, was to simplify things, but also, incredibly importantly, he wanted to distinguish his language of the new independent nation from that of British English. He wanted it to be a badge of identity. So reject, I think Lynn Murphy, who's written a wonderful book on this called The Prodigal Tongue, what she said was, rejecting the king's English was another way of rejecting the king. And I think that's really important. He wanted a national language, and that national language was going to have its own spelling rules.
Gosh. Where are you on this? I mean, if we are in English, we would spell analogue, G-U-E at the mm-hmm. end, wouldn't we? We'd spell catalogue, G-U-E, dialogue, G-U-E.
Yeah.
But Americans would not use the U-E.
No.
We would spell travelled with two L's and they'd spell it with one L.
Yes.
We'd do, manoeuvre as in O-E-U-V-R-E and they'd do it M-A-E-U-V-E-R.
Yeah, because that's the way you sound. I mean, we're just sticking to the French, but who's to say that the French is any better? You know, I'm not arguing for a standard against a standard at all. Of course, we all need to follow certain rules if we're going to be understood correctly. So that's the importance of rules, is that we communicate clearly and effectively. But why we reserve this hatred for American English when Sometimes it is much simpler, and it's not just spelling jars either, because sometimes their words are much more obvious than ours. So, for example, if you talk about black pudding these days, it gives you no idea about what's in a black pudding, but the Americans call it a blood sausage. I mean, how much clearer can you get? They talk about expressways rather than motorways, which, again, is much clearer. They talk about torches as being flashlights. They talk about the main street for the high street. You know, why is the street high? I just think in those cases, American English is quite clean. I'm not saying it's the better kind, but, you know, it makes sense.
I'm just looking for my list. I have a list of amusing words. For example, a skipping rope, I see, is called a jump rope. That
there
makes
you go.
More sense.
Overalls are called coveralls. That makes sense too. They talk about dishwashing liquid, not washing up liquid.
Oh.
Again, makes much more sense. It should be said.
This is interesting.
Yeah.
This could raise confusion. A sleeping partner is a silent partner.
Well, we talk about both, don't we?
Well, I think a sleeping partner, I think they mean there somebody in a company.
Yes.
Who is the sleeping partner.
We talk about a silent partner.
Do we? I don't think
we
do.
That's American influence, probably.
And what about a slow coach being a slow poke? There could be confusion
that's
there.
That's true. That's not quite so
I'm sorry.
Obvious, is it?
I'm letting my, you know, anyway. What is this? A tick is a check mark.
Mm-hmm.
A ticket tout is a scalper. They don't have timber, they have lumber. They don't have a titbit, they have a tidbit.
Yeah.
They don't have a toffee apple, they have a candy apple or a caramel apple.
Love it. I mean, I put my hands up. I did live in America for 4 years.
Oh, well,
and actually, having a British,
4 years.
British English accent really was brilliant.
Where were you in America?
I lived in New York because I went to Princeton for a few years. And
Princeton, the university?
The university. And then, yeah, lived in New York.
What were you doing there?
I did a degree in German, comparative literature in German, that kind of thing, which is a bit of an odd thing to do, but I didn't know what I wanted to do after university, so I went there and absolutely loved it. And then I taught German to freshman and sophomore students. It was great.
Explain that to me. I've never been able to absorb that. Sophomore is the first year?
Yeah, sophomore, second year.
And sophomore, second year, what's the third year?
Third year. I can't actually remember.
And then they have a fourth year. They have to go on year after year after year because
there
the
is
first...
a word. I can't remember what it is. Apologies to all American listeners. But you could just get me started on American English. They've given us so many wonderful words like skedaddle. Where would we be without skedaddling?
What's the origin of skedaddle?
I don't think anyone knows. It just sounds like kind of absquatulating, which is a sort of more boring, formal, made up English, British English word for leaving somewhere in a hurry.
Absquatulating. I've been to America a great deal, and during my gap year, when I left school, I had a year off before going to university.
Yes.
And I went to America, mm-hmm. Which was then quite an exciting thing to do. I mean, now, curiously, my grandchildren, things, they think of going to Vietnam, you know, during their gap year.
Yeah,
that's their idea. Well, when I was, you couldn't go to Vietnam. There was a war on.
Mm.
You know, you now go, people are lying on the killing fields as though they were beaches. Anyway, that's a different matter. I went to America and I ended up teaching at a school in Baltimore, Maryland. The Park School, Baltimore. I remember it vividly. To date this for people interested in history, Spiro T. Agnew.
Oh, wow.
Spiro Agnew was the governor of Maryland at the time.
Yeah.
I remember this because an anagram of Spiro Agnew is grow a penis. And that was the first graffiti I saw when I arrived. I thought, what are these signs all over Baltimore saying grow a penis? And they said, oh, it's the governor. I said, what do you mean it's the governor? It's an anagram of his name, Spiro Agnew. He became vice president, I think.
Okay, yes, he was, definitely. Yeah. It was very political, yes.
But speaking of vice presidents, and this is an aside, but we can come back to it. You've heard of Dan Quayle?
Yes.
Cool. Another vice president. Why have you
Potato.
Heard of Dan Quayle? Exactly.
It's so sad.
But no, this is why language is important. This is if you're wondering
true.
Why you're listening to this
I
podcast,
just feel sorry for the poor
it's because
man.
Language is power.
Yes.
We have a vice president of the United States of America. The only reason I have heard of Spiro Agnew is his name is an anagram of grow a penis. The only reason you have heard of Dan Quayle is because at a school somewhere in the Midwest, he corrected a kid's spelling. The child had spelt potato.
Yeah, I think he was just exemplifying plurals and accidentally missed off an E.
Yeah, and he spelled...
But let's face it, Dan Quayle's linguistic misdemeanours are as nothing compared with Donald Trump's.
I agree. We'll come on to Donald Trump in a moment.
Yes.
But just all I'm wanting to make people understand is that language does define you.
That's very
people
true.
Remember you because of your use of words.
Yeah.
There's no question of that. I'm a friend of the British politician, John Prescott, people in America not knowing who John Prescott is. He's a former British Deputy Prime Minister. He's an amateur pugilist and a man who has the gift of using the English language like a Rubik cube. The last time I saw him was in the House. He's now in the House of Lords. And he was looking very green about the gills. He's looking peaky. He said, "I'm peaky." He said, "I've just come off an aeroplane." He said, "A terrible flight from Brussels." He said, "Thank God I'm back on terracotta." The way you use words defines you. The way Dan Quayle spelt potato, I've read his autobiography, and not a very fun read, but he admits in it that it was the most awful experience of his life. That is how you are seen. How you use words makes a difference. Though you can, talking about Donald Trump, I mean, I'm fascinated by Donald. What a phenomenon, Donald Trump. What a phenomenon.
Looking askance here.
You can look askance. I think it is amazing. The very fact that Donald Duck and Woody Woodpecker had a love child seems to me incredible. And he has succeeded in making the tweet the means of communication from the head of the largest, most powerful country in the world.
Grammatically incorrect tweet, let's face it. But anyway, I'm not really a pedant, only when it comes to him. Can I just introduce you to one word that I love?
Yes.
I'm obviously showing my political colours madly here, but it's a wonderful word that I discovered in the OED, and that is trumperiness. Trumperiness, going back to the 19th century, and it means something that is showy and kind of boastful, I guess, but ultimately utterly worthless.
Say it again. Trumpery.
Something that is showy but utterly worthless.
And what is the origin of that? Does it come... because there's... Trump is short for trumpet, isn't it?
Trump is short for trumpet. Or if you're talking about cards, it's, you know, sort of show your trumps or the game
no trumps,
trumps, indeed.
Yeah.
No trumps. That's short for triumph. So Donald will probably choose that version. But of course, it's also blowing hot air or blowing air of any description if you're talking about the British trumping.
But haven't you found how curious it is that people often live up to their names? No.
Nominative determinism.
Is that what it's called?
Yes.
But it is an interesting phenomenon.
Yes.
I mean, Oscar Wilde was a great believer in it, you know.
Was he?
And I think if he hadn't been called Wilde, he wouldn't have been quite as he was. People do deliver. There's a wasn't there the head of the judiciary who was called Lord Judge?
Mm-hmm. Probably.
Yeah, there definitely was.
Okay.
And there's some. So there you are. Trump. He is Trump.
Which definition you choose.
It's perfect for you. He either triumphs or he's full of hot air.
Yes. Take your pick.
you take your pick. When I taught at this Park School in Baltimore, and there was a wonderful teacher called Mr. Russell. This was the days when I don't even know what his first name was. You call teachers Mr. or Miss or, you know, anyway. Mr. Russell, he taught English. And he was very keen on traditional American spellings and traditional punctuation. And I remember him saying to me that without the apostrophe, he really believed in the apostrophe. This is perhaps tells you more about me than it does about him. I remember him saying that without the apostrophe, how are you going to tell the difference between feeling your nuts and feeling your nuts? What's your favourite American, totally American word? Maybe it is skedaddle.
Scurry funge.
Scary funge?
Scurry funge. Anyone who knows me on Twitter will know I talk about this all the time. Scurry funge is from the most wonderful American dialect dictionary. There's a project which I think is sadly very slowly winding down, but it's called DARE, the Dictionary of American Regional English. And they collect words from across the country because, you know, American English has vastly more dialects than we do, local dialects than we do. And scurry funging in American dialect is to basically run around the house in a frenetic attempt to tidy up just before visitors arrive.
Oh, that's great.
That's scurry funging.
Speaking of American presidents, I was a great fan of George Bush Jr. Because he did amazing things with the English language. He is the fellow, isn't it, who said, the trouble with the French is they don't have a word for entrepreneur. I used to collect Bushisms. I'll see if I can find a couple to share with you. And then you can tell me if actually, I know you don't think much of Mr. Trump, you made that clear. Do you think Trump has had an effect? Has Twitter had an effect, and Trump, the way he uses language, had an effect on the way we use language? Has the tweet changed our English usage?
I don't think his tweets have necessarily. I think, as you say, it's far more about kind of political style because he is arguably the first person to use new media in the way that he has. Well, I just love the covfefe kerfuffle.
Oh, what was that about?
Do you remember Covfefe? He just I can't remember what the first two words were, but he just said something, something, Covfefe, and then that was it. And it was very late at night, C-O-V-F-E-F-E. And clearly was either too tired or possibly too compromised to finish his tweet. And
too compromised. What is that supposed to mean?
Anything you like. And so there was so much speculation as to what Covfefe meant, although obviously everyone knew it was just an error. But what was awful and cringeably embarrassing was that his communications director, whoever it was, now gone, obviously, like the rest of them, said that clearly President Trump knew what he was saying when he put that down, as if it had some kind of secret meaning that the rest of us didn't know. But it was great because so many brands grabbed the opportunity and just went with, grab a Covfefe today if you need waking up, all sorts of things. Anyway, it was great because it could mean anything you wanted it to. Can we just end with the phrase that everybody sees as being quintessentially British, because there are so many misunderstandings. You know, I think Marty Wilde, in a programme I did about American English, in which I was championing, the wonders of the American language, Marty Wilde said, well, my favourite American word of all has to be wow. The three letters that just say it all. In fact, it's first recorded in 16th century Scotland. So that's one misapprehension.
Wow.
Yes.
But okay, another one. Away. Wow. It's a Scottish word.
It is a Scottish word. What? How can you think of anything?
Did it
more?
Mean? Was it an exclamation?
It
wow.
Was, it was. It
right
was.
From the beginning?
Yes.
And when you say 16, do you mean 1500s?
It was 1500s, I'm pretty sure.
No.
Yes, it was
fantastic.
1500s.
1500s, fantastic.
What
wow.
could be more quintessentially British, though, than the stiff upper lip?
Indeed.
Right, we think about our stiff upper lip. Makes you think of all sorts of
kind I'm in
of Monty Python.
Can I say I'm in favour of the stiff upper lip?
Are you?
We've had enough blubbing. Honestly, we really have.
We're talking about snowflakes.
The blubbing has got to stop.
The blubbing. But do you know what? Stiff upper lip, originally American.
Really?
Yes.
Where does it come from?
It was, I'm not actually sure about the first record, but the second record that we have was from Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Ah.
So, so many wrong ideas about American English. And we love Indian English. We love Singapore English. We welcome, all sorts of varieties into our language, except, it seems, American English. Let's relax that stiff upper lip and let some of them in.
Okay. Have you got one? You should give us a threesome of words. Maybe you've given us so many.
I've given you scurry funge. Scurry funge, definitely one of my three today. So scurry funging.
What did it mean again?
Okay, so scurry funging is madly rushing around the house.
Oh, yes.
Tidy up, throw everything in cupboards just before visitors arrive.
Very good. Scurry funging. When was that invented?
That was US dialect, so it's probably been around since the 1800s.
It's a good American word.
Yes.
Stop scurry funging.
Stop scurry funging. So I've also mentioned skedaddle, because I just love skedaddle.
I love skedaddle.
Skedaddle is great.
What does that mean? It just means to rush off.
Let's skedaddle.
Yeah, let's skedaddle.
It's just got that mischief about it, which I really like. And my third one is something I actually tweeted about it not so long ago, which was boondoggle. Now, American listeners will know this very, very well. A boondoggle. If you say someone's off on a boondoggle, they're off on a kind of fruitless expedition, but a bit of a sort of freebie, a bit of a jolly is a boondoggle. But actually, for us in British English, it tends to mean an entirely futile or unnecessary undertaking. So a complete waste of time is a boondoggle.
Well, this hasn't been a boondoggle as far as I'm concerned.
Let's hope not.
I have learnt a lot, as I always do, in your company, Susie Dent. I think let's skedaddle.
Let's do that thing.
Oh, look. If you've been enjoying this, please do rate and review us. And also press subscribe. They've got to do that, haven't they?
Yes.
Do you know how it works?
Yes.
How does one do that?
Tap.
I don't know how any of this works, I'm new to all this.
Oh, yes. No, they need to subscribe, and that would be, if they like it. If you like it, it would mean a lot to us if you did subscribe. And
if you don't like it, fuck off. I'm saying that only as a tease, because in the next podcast, we're actually going to talk about bad language.
Yes.
So that we may well have edited that out before we subscribe.
I think our studio director's just fainted.
Something Rhymes with Purple is a Something Else production. It was produced by Paul Smith, with additional production from Russell Finch, Steve Ackerman, and Josh Gibbs.